From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Today, President Putin has made a statement in which he accused Ukraine in making provocations along the border with Crimea.
That was Vladimir Yelchenko, who's the permanent representative of Ukraine to the UN, at a press encounter at UN headquarters in New York Wednesday following a Security Council session on the situation in Ukraine.
Accusing Ukraine of turning to terror instead of peaceful of seeking the peaceful solutions to the conflict, which sounds absolutely ridiculous. As you well know, first to react was the Minister of Defense of Ukraine, which very clearly stated that there were absolutely no any military activities along the border with Crimea, and that Ukraine never sought to solve any issues with Russia by military means. But instead, this was called as a fake provocation by the Russian Federation, and then accusing Ukraine in doing something which Ukraine never did. But let me first read to you the statement by the Foreign Minister of Ukraine, which was just issued a couple of minutes ago actually, and which will be circulated obviously as a document of the General Assembly and the Security Council. Ukraine condemns in the strongest terms yet another Kremlin manufactured provocation and rejects all accusations which are completely groundless.
Russia's Federal Security Forces, the FSB, reported that they prevented a terrorist attack in Crimea that it said was planned by Ukrainian Defense Ministry's intelligence agency. RT's Emily Hsu has more.
Russia's Federal Security Service, or the FSB, has successfully intercepted and prevented two terrorist attacks in Crimea. According to the FSB, the terrorist groups were planning to target key infrastructure in Crimea in a bid to sabotage the ongoing preparations for the elections there. During the raids, one FSB officer and one Russian serviceman was killed as the both sides exchanged gunfire. And at the site of those raids, they were able to uncover explosives and ammunition, including grenades. The FSB also added that because of these raids, they were able to uncover a network of agents reportedly working for Ukraine's chief intelligence agency. The group consists of both Russian and Ukrainian nationals, and the FSB says that they have confessed to the plans of the attacks during the ongoing investigation. According to the FSB, one of the suspects arrested and identified is an officer working for Ukraine's defense ministry. The Ukrainian authorities have dismissed the allegation, describing it as a provocation. Meanwhile, Russia has tightened security across the peninsula, particularly at its border with Ukraine.
Meanwhile, a high-profile supporter of Hillary Clinton, the former CIA deputy director and former acting director, Michael Morell, insists that Donald Trump is being manipulated by Russian President Vladimir Putin. He said Russians and Iranians in Syria should be killed covertly to pay the price of their involvement there.
We need to make the Iranians pay a price in Syria. We need to make the Russians pay a price. The other thing I would do...
We make them pay the price by killing Russians?
Yes.
Former MI5 agent turned whistleblower Annie Machon, speaking with RT, suggested Morell might have a personal motive for his public statements of support for Clinton and attacks on Trump.
This is more like an alarming job application by Morell. So he would love to have a senior post in any Clinton administration if she were to be elected. And he's saying what he thinks she would like to hear about how America should deal with the situation in the Middle East. And if indeed this does reflect her own views, then we've got to the absurd position where actually world peace might be in safer hands if Donald Trump were elected president.
The mysterious death of a 27-year-old DNC staffer in Washington, D.C., is the subject of interest of none other than WikiLeaks.
Our whistleblowers go to significant efforts to get us material and often very significant risks.
That was WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, still stuck inside the London Embassy of Ecuador, where he's been given sanctuary since 2012.
As a 27-year-old, I works for the DNC, who was shot in the back, murdered just 2 weeks ago.
That was just a robbery, I believe, wasn't it?
No.
Assange was referring to the murder of Democratic National Committee staffer Seth Rich in Washington, D.C. He said the whistleblowing organization WikiLeaks wants to catch those responsible and are now offering a $20,000 reward for information. RT's Asa Ali has been following this story and filed this report from London.
Seth Rich was 27 years old when he was killed. He was the DNC's voter expansion data director. He was shot twice in the back. Now, the police have said that his killing could have been a robbery, but none of his personal belongings had gone missing. There have been no witnesses. And there were no suspects either. So that's led to a flurry of theories online that people saying that he was possibly the one who leaked these documents, these emails, tens of thousands of them, and that he has somehow been killed, perhaps, as a result of it. Now, that's not what Julian Assange is saying. He himself is merely offering money for any information into Mr. Rich's death. But those are the theories online. But we've seen other theories regarding the leak of these emails. There have been many conspiracy theories saying that Russia has been behind these leaks and that they were the ones who leaked these emails. And that narrative has even found its way into some of the most prominent Western media outlets.
And we now go to Margaret Kimberly, columnist at blackagendareport.com with the Freedom Rider column. And this week's column is entitled simply, Police State Fascism. Margaret, nice to speak with you again.
You too, Don.
So this week's column, Freedom Rider at blackagendareport.com, Police State Fascism. It starts out noting that the word fascism has reappeared in the American popular lexicon thanks to the Trump campaign, the words being used to keep progressive Democrats in a state of fear about his possible win. But the existence in this country right now of fascism is rarely discussed. So let's start discussing it.
Sure. You know, everyone who is afraid of Trump uses the word fascism, and it's part of a trend of people using the most hyperbolic language possible to try to make a point. But with Trump, it's used over and over and over again. And I think it's an opportunity for us to talk about what is fascism, what does that look like? And I have concluded we already have it. We have a fascistic system. And the most, the way it is, used most often is against mostly poor black people through the criminal justice system, through mass incarceration, through interactions with police, which we now know very often result in death, at least one black, well, three people killed every day by police. That in itself is fascistic. One of those people will be black. And if we're going to talk about fascism in America, we should really talk about it. We should talk about the way it appears and the fact that it is so constant, that it is so consistent, that it is not, no politician touches it. The only changes made to it by politicians are to make it worse. So you have a war on drugs, and a Republican or a Democrat, it doesn't seem to matter who, campaigns on a platform of arresting more people, criminalizing very minor things, not paying bills or child support, anything can be used to uphold this police state. And that is the most common manifestation of fascism in the country. So if people are going to keep using this word, we need to really talk about it and talk about how, about the fact that it already exists and that it will continue to exist no matter who is elected president in November.
You know, the imagery that pops into my mind as a child of the age into which I was born of police state is either an image of Nazi Germany or of the Soviet Union. And
yeah,
that which is fascism rests on targeting minority groupings or some other and giving them the full brunt of the state apparatus, which, of course, remains for anybody else. But at least they get to exercise it regularly against this demonized grouping. The U.S. seems to fall into that category.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, perfectly. And but it's interesting to me that this connection is rarely made. And even organizations such as Black Lives Matter, who as an organization I have issues with, do not talk about this in the way that I believe they ought to. You can't. We act as though police brutality, police murder, is just something that happens to be out there, and it's bad training, or, you know, yes, of course, there's a little racism too, or, you know, but it's all very vague, and people just shrug their shoulders. Gee, how do we stop this? And let's have another protest. And I'm all in favor of protest, but if you don't talk about what it really is and how it is manifested and how it is maintained, then you're wasting your time. We have to condemn the entire system wholeheartedly, condemn the whole premise of our prison system, condemn the fact there are groups now who are talking about abolishing the police, which I think is a far more useful conversation for us to ask, why do we have police? What do we need them for? Right. Do they really protect us? Who do they really protect? So that's the direction I hope that we go in. And I think if people are going to, you know, talk about fascism and talk about being afraid, we need to talk about who ought to be afraid in this country. Omali Yeshitel of the Black is Back Coalition says that fascism is white people being afraid that they'll be treated like black people. And I think we're sort of saying a similar thing. So being worried because, you know, there's some rednecks being rude at a Donald Trump rally, calling that fascism, when we have a country that is the biggest police state in the world, where police routinely kill people and are allowed to do so. Every year the police kill 1,100 people in this country. There are countries which have never, ever had 1,100 police killings, ever. So if we're going to start using this word and throwing it around so much, let's really talk about it. Let's talk about what fascism really looks like. And as you said, the targeting of a minority group. Anti-black racism is persistent. And there are other groups who can become more accepted. So gay people can get married, which I think is a good thing. Now there's a lot of concern expressed for the transgender community. That's okay with me. But to have conversations and laws passed about trans people being able to use the restroom of their choice when nothing is done to stop this murder and to stop these horrible human rights abuses is proof to me that what I'm saying is true. And whatever else changes, anti-black racism and the police state being used to uphold it, the fact that that never ends is an important point.
I mean, that's a material point, and you went right to that material point at the onset of this piece, saying if Trump became president and was indeed a fascist, he wouldn't bring anything to the country that is not already in existence for black Americans, saying that fascism is practiced against them on a daily basis.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there have been several stories in the news, and I talk about the shooting of a woman in Baltimore, a young mother, by police, who say that she pointed a shotgun at them, and she was being arrested for her boyfriend. She said there was a domestic violence charge that she made against him, and she'd had an interaction for a traffic violation, very minor things, but she ends up dead.
Right.
And the police, she attempted to live stream the encounter, and Facebook did what the police told them to and cut off her feed, and they claimed she had a shotgun and pointed it at them. I have no idea if that's true or not. And in any case, the details don't really matter because black people can be armed or unarmed. It doesn't, excuse me, necessarily have any bearing on whether or not we get killed. And so there was that story of another police murder. There was another story of a young man in Chicago accused of stealing a car, shot in the back. And in both these cases, these body cams, all these this talk of reform, well, if police just are constantly being videoed, well, they turn them off.
Right.
In both these cases, they just,
right.
for you know, miraculously, at the moment when the shots are fired, the body cameras were off.
Right. Statistically impossible as coincidence, ridiculously so.
It is, it is. And then, of course, they worked as soon as the killing was over. Their
right.
cameras are turned back on. And then there was a case of something that isn't talked about very often, and it's the way people are treated while in custody. A story of a woman, in unnamed woman in Kentucky, who showed up in court with no pants. The judge says, "Where are your pants?" She'd been denied pants and feminine hygiene products in jail. Why was she being held? She had a shoplifting charge a couple of years ago, and she was supposed to complete some sort of program and didn't. So she ends up in jail for several days. And the judge was in the news, and people applauded the judge. She got on the phone and said, "What the hell's going on? Why doesn't this woman have any pants?" And but it, you know, so but the judge got the attention, not the fact
right.
that this woman and thousands of people like her end up in jail and in danger for very, very minor. I won't even call them crimes. I'll say infractions. And there was a study released last week in the state of Texas. Nearly 7,000 people died in police custody, in jails or prison, in over a 10-year period.
Wow.
And that's just one state.
That's like two a day.
Yes, it is. And just in Texas. That doesn't tell you anything about the other 49 states.
Wow.
So that is fascism at work. And it's something that we... need to talk about a lot more.
So as you close the piece, you said that all the videos in the world wouldn't upend the brutality of the laws that are enforced against black people. And you mentioned, you know, just now, again, some of those laws are really minor infractions. Even the drug laws, the majority of people in jail for drug offenses are people that had a nickel bag of marijuana.
Yes, it's just for possession. And I remember when these draconian laws were first being proposed, and what were we promised? They're going to get the kingpins. I was never sure what a kingpin was or why that word was so popular with members of Congress, but we're going to get the kingpins, not the low-level people. Well, of course, who's in jail? Low-level people. People who should not be in jail at all for having weed or even having cocaine and heroin. We need to decriminalize drug possession altogether, I believe. But these draconian sentences, people doing essentially life sentences for drug crime, and these laws are targeted at black people. When crack cocaine was declared a great evil, and this was a drug that was sold mostly by black people, there were no white people anywhere in the country sentenced for these crack cocaine offenses. And even then, when Obama signed a bill which lessened the disparity in sentencing between powder and crack cocaine, the people who'd been sentenced prior don't have a right to be request resentencing.
Right.
And that's because of the Obama administration. They were opposed to it. So all his talk of getting people out of jail is phony because he had a chance to do it. He could have given those people the right to request resentencing, but did not. When yet another case of him getting too much credit. But this goes on and on and on. And crime is seen as being, it's a synonym for black criminal and criminality and crime. That means black people. And politicians rarely lose because they promise to beat up on black people. Now, they don't say black people. They'll talk about crime. But it's a winning formula for any politician, Democrat or Republican.
You mentioned also that none of the supposedly non-fascist politicians dare lay a finger on the modern-day slave system, which is the way you characterize it. Many people characterize it. So I'm assuming, for example, and perhaps in particular, you're referring to Hillary Clinton, who actually had a hand in selling some of the legislation back during her husband's administration that has placed a lot of these folks in prison, where they remain. I mean, Trump has been exciting. He's the law and order president, he says, which invokes Nixon and that entire war on black people that's followed since. Clinton has her hands dirty with that. What do people do?
Well, it's one of, you know, one of 100 reasons not to support her. It has become, automatic that black people support the Democrat, and that's very dangerous for a lot of reasons. There are no demands made. It's just accepted. Go along with the Democrat. It does. You know, Bill Clinton was reelected, got 99% of the black vote when he ran a second time. That was after the welfare bill, after the crime bill, and we see it again with Hillary Clinton. And Trump has been turned into this monster. So you can't even criticize Hillary Clinton or even ask a question about her without someone shouting at you, "Do you want Trump?" So once again, we see this sad story, and we know how it's going to turn out, where there's no question of supporting Hillary Clinton. And no one even says, no one dares suggest to black elected officials or organizations, no one says, well, ask her a question, make a demand. We'll support you if you do this. We'll support you if you allow people to be resentenced, if you look at changing the drug laws, if you force the Justice Department to keep track of the number of people killed by the police. No one says anything. It's just we have to support her. And it doesn't matter. Her past history is just swept away as if it never happened. When she was running against Obama back in 2008, there was a lot of resentment about the way she treated Obama in that campaign, and there were people who said they would never vote for her. Well, that's disappeared. People, even the allegiance to Obama is forgotten. She's a Democrat. She's running for president, so we're going to have to be behind her. And it's one of many reasons why I cannot be behind her. I'm going to vote green, but yeah, it doesn't. It's all forgotten. And by the way, I just wanted to mention one other thing. I just reminded myself this week, Trump made some unusual Trumpian fashion. He made a remark about the Second Amendment people taking care of Hillary Clinton, and it was seen as a threat or a call for her to be assassinated. But she very openly said that in 2008. She made a cryptic reference to Bobby Kennedy being shot during his presidential campaign, and she says, well, you know, Obama could be shot or something along those lines.
I should stay in the race because the possibility exists that, think of Bobby Kennedy.
Yes.
Yeah.
And everybody forgets that, too. So, you know, when it comes to the levels of political corruption in this country are seen in so many different ways. And Democrats just going along with anything a Democrat does is an example of that kind of corruption that needs to be done away with.
You know, this past Wednesday night, Jill Stein got an hour on CNN, and it seems to be a recognition of the fact that both the original lift given to the libertarians by them getting a lot of press, and my personal belief is that's because the Koch brothers are behind stopping Trump, and it was done to peel off the votes from the Republican base. But Stein has been sort of pulled in tow behind that in the Greens, and they're polling now, like I heard from someone this morning, that she's polling 8% among black voters. All of this, of course, raises the specter of either a brokered, electoral college going to the the House of Representatives, or the invoking increasingly by the Democrats of a Nader effect, and that would be intended to chill it. But, you know, the conditions are much different now than they've ever been, really, with the dissatisfaction among the working class, among just about everybody but the 1%, finding expression here and there where it can leak out. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are about the likelihood of the Greens doing well, not just the 5%, but actually maybe being players at the margin.
It's hard to say. I don't know how much, what the percentage, overall percentage of votes Nader got in 2000, which I guess was the best year for
One or two percent. 1 or 2%. It was de minimis, really.
Yeah. I don't think, even if she polls, above 5%, I don't see her getting more than 5% actually come election day. But it could be key in certain states. But I don't think, frankly, that we're there yet, as much as I would like it, as happy as that would make me. I don't think the Green Party is at a point of really impacting an election, but I think we have to start. We have to talk about it differently. I think we have to talk about replacing the Democratic Party. And I think we have to start using language like that and start thinking about what has to come after them, so that we don't have what we have now, where Republicans who gave a lot of money in the primaries to John Kasich and Chris Christie now giving money to Hillary Clinton, and progressives are told that we have to go along with the same person who was supported by Republicans. So I think this should be the start of a conversation of how to build a party, how to put a party out of business. Because it's happened before in American history. There were parties that don't exist any longer.
Yeah.
And so I think it has to be discussed that way. We've got to replace the Democrats so we don't go through this year after year of supporting people we don't like and being told that the Republicans are so evil and horrible. We've got to, the whole lesser evilism argument needs to die. And this can be the start of it. But that's as far as I can see that happening this year, and we need to spend the next few years talking about the way that we just get the Democrats out altogether.
And finally, one of your colleagues or co-columnists at Black Agenda Report is the vice presidential nominee of the Green Party, Ajamu Baraka.
Yeah, that is great news. I was very excited to hear that. Ajamu is a longtime activist, campaigner for human rights, truly campaigning for human rights and not for the United States to do whatever it wants. And he is a staunch opponent of imperialism, a staunch opponent of the police state. So I think he is a perfect person to play this role this year.
And he's had a heavy hand in bringing the U.S. in front of the U.N. Human Rights Commission on its treatment of black folks in the United States.
Yes, he has. So he, is something what I wrote right about this week. We have to see the treatment of black people as a human rights abuse. And for the United States, for Americans to go on and on about human rights abuses somewhere else in the world, when we have this grotesque situation here, is so hypocritical, and it needs to end. So we have to be grateful to people like Ajamu Baraka for bringing our plight before the world community.
Margaret Kimberly, thank you very much. Your column this week at Freedom Rider, Police State Fascism. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.